Matt Rothschild here with another episode of the Wisconsin Forward podcast on Civic Media. Today I'll be talking with Jim Santel, host of the great program Amicus, a Law Review. We'll be discussing recent changes at the Wisconsin Supreme Court, as well as three of the most pivotal decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court over the last 15 years. I hope you'll enjoy this conversation.
Matt, good to be with you. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, indeed, I'm the host of Amicus Law Review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Also a practicing attorney who's out there doing cases in the state and sometimes federal courts. Delighted to be with you as a part of your discussion today.
Well, let's start with the Wisconsin Supreme Court's role in the attempt to overturn the 2020 elections. Were you surprised at the role it played and how close it came to overturning our votes here in Wisconsin?
Right. Again, it is an expression of both the power of our Supreme Court, of judges generally, and also of the importance of who's on that court, right? Because as we know, and I know that you're going to be discussing this as well, the court has changed a lot in recent years and may change again in the near future. And one of the concerns that I think many of us have when we look at not only decisions in the midst of the 2020 challenge and all of that is that the law should not be based upon, and decisions coming out of the Supreme Court should not be based upon the partisan views or the ideological views of the people who are there. And I think that's what animates a lot of the court, regrettably, today here in the state of Wisconsin, in this case certainly, and in others. And so if I say that I wasn't surprised to see it, that is a genuine expression of how I feel about it. It's also an expression of some regret that we have become politicized to the point that we bring onto the court our own ideological views, our own partisan views, and those end up in the decisions of the majority.
It was amazing to me, Jim, that three of the four conservative justices seemed perfectly willing to toss out all of our votes in one of the challenges,
right.
Hundreds of thousands of votes in another one. And it took a conservative justice who ran as a very conservative Republican Party, social conservative favorite, Brian Hagedorn,
right.
to actually stand on principle here.
Right. And exactly. We saw him, of course, during the campaign and anticipated that he would be on the bench, exactly as you described him, Matt, a very conservative jurist and member of the Supreme Court. And in many ways, he has shown that he is not that, right? And the illustration that we're talking about right now kind of confirms that. He decides, no, indeed, this is not only what is good for the state of Wisconsin, but it's also inconsistent with the law. And he's willing to say, you know what? I may have an ideological view that is conservative, that is in this particular direction, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to give up the oath of office that I've taken to do what is right. And he does that. And he's done that in other circumstances as well, certainly drawing the ire of the conservatives out there who thought he would be uniform in his delivery of decisions there. But again, I would offer that Hagedorn is the kind of justice, at least in some of these cases, if not all of them, that you would anticipate from all the justices, not just him.
Yeah, in one of these cases, he said the Trump team or advocates for the Trump team were asking for the most dramatic invocation of judicial power I have ever seen. Mm-hmm. Some of his quotes in this series of cases were very dramatic and so set on principle that we're just not going to take an unprecedented step in disenfranchising tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or maybe everybody who voted in the 2020 election when they were doing so under the instructions that they were given.
Exactly. And so two things going on there. Number one, he is once again advancing his basic allegiance to the rule of law and saying this is what has got to happen here. And second, in the quote that you just read and other things coming out of those writings from him and others, this notion that if we decide something today, we're also setting precedent for the future. He's very concerned about what is coming next. And justices, judges are always concerned. They always ask, Mr. Santel, if we agree with you here, what about the next case out there? And that's what we're also hearing from Brian Hagedorn as he articulates that view, concerned about the people, certainly the state of Wisconsin, concerned about the law, and also about what comes next.
Yeah, here's a perfect quote from another one of those decisions by Justice Hagedorn, ruling 4-3. We only have 7 Supreme Court justices here in Wisconsin, saying this is a dangerous path we're being asked to tread. The loss of public trust in our constitutional order resulting from the exercise of this kind of judicial power would be incalculable.
Right. And there, too, underscoring the notion that if you have concerns about what your government is doing, if you've got a dispute with people, whether they're private or public, where have we always gone in the state of Wisconsin, 1848, even before that, certainly in our nation? We go to the courts because we view judges and even panels of judges as being the fair and decent arbiters of our disputes. If it's not that, and our judicial system doesn't give us that, what's left? That is the beginning of the destruction of our basic standards and processes. That's what he's also concerned about when he breaks ranks with his other conservatives on the bench.
And as you mentioned, they were vicious, especially Justice Rebecca Bradley, in attacking him for his stance here, which I think will look good historically.
Yes.
But I wonder if the rancor from his side makes him sometimes say, well, you know what, if that's how you're going to treat me, maybe I'll, you know, just hear what some of the other justices are saying, including Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who's retiring, who's a very graceful person.
Right.
And the other justices on the liberal side, I know, have made an effort to be socially friendly with Justice Hagedorn, both out of decency, which they all should have.
Right.
And also maybe in a way to say, look, you know, if they're going to treat you badly, we treat you nice over here, even when we disagree. So
we have got a group over here that is not going to engage in that kind of invective, both in writing. And Rebecca Bradley has done this in other cases as well, even very recent cases, too, even on something, for example, involving the drop boxes. The level of vitriol, accusing other members of the Supreme Court of engaging in rank politics is what she hurled at Brian Hagedorn, has done that in the past. That kind of language doesn't get you anywhere, right? What does it say? It doesn't comment upon the merits of what's happening here. It simply says, I'm angry with you. And again, I would offer that that's not good jurisprudence. That's what we want from our judges, our justices generally. And the other takeaway, Matt, from your very good point here is these people are human beings, right? They go to the grocery store, they drive their cars, they bring their children to school, all the kinds of things that we all do. And will they wear their emotions on the sleeve? Well, hopefully not. Hopefully not, but they are human beings. And if you attack me in this public domain, if you print something, even in your dissent, and you call names of the sort that we are now seeing in our political arena as well, I am a human being. I'm not going to respond well to that. And in another circumstance where the issue is closer, I may say, gee, I don't necessarily want to affiliate with this side that is engaging in that kind of name calling and that kind of vitriol. It does have its impact. These folks are human beings.
And then the Wisconsin Supreme Court flipped in kind of a surprise victory. Justice Protasiewicz came on the court. It was 4-3 conservative. She's a liberal. It quickly switched over to a 4-3 liberal majority. What difference has that made?
It has made a significant difference because, among other cases, we just saw that the now majority on the court has done something that affects the way that we vote. Here in Wisconsin, and again, reversing the previous decision of the prior panel that said that drop boxes are not constitutional, they're not consistent with the law. Now we have them in our elections going forward. Again, a 4-3 slight, but nonetheless majority there. It does make a difference. And to my point before about the importance of the law, what Ann Walsh Bradley says in her opinion is not based upon vitriol. It's not based upon partisan politics. She says, I'm looking at the language. I'm looking at the rule. What does it say? And she says, you know what? It permits clerks to use these boxes. You don't have to. It's discretionary. But that's what the language says. That's what a judge does. And I would offer that Ann Walsh Bradley's opinion in that case is illustrative of what the present majority tries to do, which is not to be partisan, but try to be a representative of the people, and specifically to make decisions based upon the law. and not upon some partisan animus.
Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is retiring in the spring. Do you have an assessment of her long term on the court?
I think her assessment, the legacy that she leaves, is outstanding. I think about other justices on the Supreme Court who have been in that same position. Undeniably, Shirley Abramson, the former Chief Justice, has a legacy that will live in Wisconsin history for decades, centuries beyond where we are today. Ann Walsh Bradley is in that same category. This is somebody who is not only, again, thoughtful. She doesn't enter that fray that discredits not only the court itself, but the entire institution. She does do things in which she says, you know what, I disagree with you on this, but I disagree with you based upon a measured, thoughtful response of mine. She explains her position, not accusing the other side of being stupid or uninformed or partisan, but describes her position in a way that we can all, if not embrace, at least understand. That educational portion of what she does cannot be overstated. She is also a fundamentally decent person. I've gotten to know her in many things outside of the court. She has been a regular at Badger Boys State, the American Legion program. She goes up there every single year and talks to young people. She does a lot of that in the community. And she is someone who is on the bench, a great public servant, and also she lives that off the bench as well. And that, too, you want from our elected judges in Wisconsin. And her legacy, again, in both those venues will continue for a very long time.
So her retirement is giving us another seesaw race here in the spring for Wisconsin Supreme Court. We've got Susan Crawford on the liberal side running against Judge Brad Schimel, used to be Attorney General. Very conservative, arch conservative, Scott Walkerite. Any sense how that race is going to go?
It is difficult to know because, as we all appreciate, Wisconsin tends to decide these cases by thousands of votes. Recall again that this is supposed to not be a partisan practice here, not a partisan election, a campaign. Regrettably, it has become that in Wisconsin. That too, we bemoan that. That is not a good thing overall, and yet that is where we are today. In that category, it is difficult to imagine two candidates who would be more different.
Jim Santel, we've seen just a ridiculous amount of money in Wisconsin Supreme Court races and in governor's races and other races. Every time there's a campaign, the record is broken for the amount spent here in Wisconsin. I wanted to ask you about Citizens United and the apparatus at the federal U.S. Supreme Court that has allowed this avalanche of money to come tumbling down here in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. Cannot be overstated. I'll use the word yet again. It cannot be overstated. This Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission was decided back in 2010. Seems like yesterday. It was 14 years ago, and it changes the ways that we think about campaign finance laws and free speech under the First Amendment. This is a 5-4 decision, basically saying that the freedom of speech clause of our First Amendment prohibits the government from restricting independent expenditures for political campaigns by, here we go, corporations, nonprofit organizations, labor unions, and other associations. That's kind of the core summary, if you will, of that majority opinion. The subject, obviously, of an awful lot of dissent, including by John Paul Stevens, who predicted that this would exactly result in the kind of thing that it has, which is money flooding into our campaigns. And while the opinion itself, again, continues to be assailable, the reality is that it is the law of the land. And again, it also, as we well know, turns back what we recall as the McCain-Feingold Act. Our own former senator here joining across the aisles with John McCain and saying, you know what, we can't have electioneering communications by incorporated entities. We don't want corporations taking over our campaigns. Let's stop that. And in the end, what the Supreme Court did in Citizens United said, you know what, that law is unconstitutional. John McCain, Russ Feingold, and all the others who supported, many others out there on both sides of the political aisle, you're simply wrong. Well, what has happened in the 14 years since that time? I would say that John McCain and Russ Feingold and all the others were right at the time. Imagine a world in which the Supreme Court had not 14 years ago said, and just as an aside, the language that corporations are people, That language actually doesn't appear in the opinion. That's the read of it. The read of some things that the Chief Justice also said really doesn't appear there.
It goes way back,
yeah. Right? But nonetheless, that they do analogize the work and the activities of corporations as and entities like those of individuals under the First Amendment. That's where that concept comes from. And they say if corporations do have the same rights as individuals, then they can pour money into campaigns as individuals can. That's where the concept is. Whether one agrees with that is another issue. I don't believe that, and I suspect that many people do not. But think about a world in which there had been one or two more justices going in the opposite direction, in which we would not have these private political action campaigns, committees, and other private entities pouring huge amounts of money, instead envisioning what McCain and Feingold thought would happen, which is individual contributions, you and me, at limits that are much lower and that are reportable, and we know where the money is coming from. Imagine a world where we weren't talking every single quarter about how much money every candidate on all sides of the political aisle has made, not only the requests that are being made of us, but also as signs of how valid your candidacy is.
Yeah,
right?
So the media reports.
The
media
money reports,
game.
Right? It's a money game. And your viability, even substantively, whether you're running for Congress, running for the United States Senate, running for the presidency, is valued somehow now in our public domain based upon how much money you raised in the last quarter, the last month, the last week. And if you don't raise those amounts, ooh, your campaign is faltering. All of that comes from Citizen United. What a disaster.
Justice Stevens, in the dissent that you mentioned, lays the groundwork for a future Supreme Court somewhere down the road that could return to his dissent and build on that for overturning Citizen United, don't you think?
Right. Absolutely. You know, this is, again, it's worth it. John Paul Stevens says a democracy cannot function effectively when its constituent members believe laws are being bought and sold. He also argued the court addressed this question about litigants under the law facially unconstitutional. He said the majority changed the case to give themselves an opportunity to change the law. Isn't that great language? Again, you can, to your good point, Matt, almost go back and adopt, if you will, the John Paul Stevens dissent, add some more language to that, respond more to the majority opinion, and come up with a decision that would support some new legislation.
And sometimes the U.S. Supreme Court in a different majority does that. They'll look back to a dissenter and say, actually, this initial decision was wrongly made.
Right.
The dissent actually presents the case in a better way.
Right. We've done that in our own history. We've got cases like Olmstead and Katz and others out there that when a Supreme Court justice articulates a certain view, for example, in the privacy rights area, the whole idea that we now somewhat embrace, although even that's being carved back now, that there's a penumbra of privacy rights that emanate from the Constitution itself. That initially was not a majority opinion. It became the majority opinion when the minority view took over the majority. That happens with regularity in the Supreme Court. And I would also argue that it underscores, it's not just because you've got Supreme Court members who are changing it at whims according to political polling. What they're doing is they're recognizing the Constitution is a living document. Mm-hmm. That what James Madison put together is a great base, a great foundation for how we should live our lives in this country. But James Madison would recognize virtually nothing about life in 2024. It's got to be alive. It's got to be a pragmatic approach to how the law is interpreted.
Jim Santel, we've talked a lot about Citizens United. I want to talk about two more recent decisions by the Roberts Court that are perhaps equally notorious. The first being the Dobbs case.
Yes. So this, again, is this major case in June of 2022. Sam Alito, writing on behalf of majority, including the Chief Justice and others, obviously, in the majority, finding for the first time in 49 years, almost 50 years, almost half a century, that what we thought was inside the Constitution, that is a privacy right that we know is there, that has been established in many, many other circumstances, that privacy right no longer extends to abortion and reproductive services. That is, again, you described it just right, Matt. That's a notorious decision. That is a huge decision, changing the very landscape not only of America, which is the number one consideration, of course, but also changing our understanding of what the Constitution does to protect us. Finding, again, privacy rights. Those go back, again, many, many years, even before Roe versus Wade. Many cases establishing that you have a right to privacy in America. Many, many other cases premised upon that fundamental notion. We always assumed that included this arc toward greater appreciation for and embracing of privacy rights. First time in 50 years, the Supreme Court says, no, let's reverse that. Let's go in the opposite direction. And says, by the way, we're out of this business now. Go back. States, you take care of this. And we're no longer be involved in this. Of course, that didn't happen even as late as the past term. Two more abortion cases come in front of them, right? So you can't just get rid of this by saying we're not going to take this anymore. The big issue, of course, is changing the very fabric of America.
Yeah, I mean, that was disingenuous. There is a lot that was disingenuous in that opinion. They were taking rights away from women that women had relied on here for 50 years. And never before do I remember a U.S. Supreme Court decision that took rights away from anybody.
Exactly.
We've been adding rights, looking at the Constitution as a living, breathing document. The principles are there. And then we infuse those principles with newly discovered rights or rights that are human rights, and we're only now coming to appreciate them. But here you had the conservative court rolling back this right, shocking to women all across America and to anyone who loves women in America. And so I was appalled by that. Also appalled by Chief Justice Roberts,
yes,
who tried to take, you know, an in-between stance here, said I wouldn't have done it as blatantly as some of the other justices, but I agree with the decision. Right. What did you make of that?
Trying very, very hard, again, to be this arbiter right in the middle, trying to find a way not to overrule Roe versus Wade from 1973, Harry Blackmun at that time, this major decision in that year, trying very hard to find a middle ground and finding among his associate justices there that there no such thing exists. And so what he says is, yes, I'm going to join the majority, but he also articulates the view that I would have maintained Roe versus Wade while also supporting the state law that prompts the litigation in the first place. Pretty difficult position to take, John. And so, again, problematic. At some point, you also look to him for some leadership on these things, right?
Yeah, I thought that was an appalling abdication of leadership. And then in the next huge, notorious case, the immunity case, he actually authored the decision.
Yes.
And he authored it in a way, and here I was being naive, because I didn't think he was going to go this far. He authored this appalling decision that says a president's above the law.
Right. That we have kings, as Sonia Sotomayor said. I often advocate for people to read the dissenting opinions. Sonia Sotomayor, Ketanji Brown Jackson, some amazingly lofty language, taking no prisoners. And I don't mean that in a violent way at all, but simply saying you've got it completely wrong and excoriating the majority opinion there. The majority opinion, as you indicated, Matt, from the Chief Justice. He chose to write that. He could assign that to somebody else. He plainly felt it was important that as the Chief Justice, he articulates this thing never before articulated in 238 years, that indeed we do have a king, apparently, as a president, that there are these things called presumptive immunities that apply, that if you commit crimes inside the White House and the Oval Office, we will presume that those are official acts and therefore there's a presumption of an immunity. And even more stunning to everybody, including me, having spent 30 years with the Department of Justice, saying that with respect to all my communications, all the presidential engagements with the Department of Justice, anything you do say, that is absolutely immune, completely off the boards. Can't prosecute for telling your attorney general to suborn perjury, to engage in obstruction of justice, to undertake investigations that have no basis. That's the very meaning and focus of the Department of Justice. Can't prosecute a president for doing exactly what Richard Nixon did. And that, too, is just stunning. It is shocking. Without hyperbole, I've often said this is an amendment to our Constitution in a way that should be completely, the words fail me. They're shocking. It's appalling. And people should be very, very animated about this, not only for the present, but for the future of our nation.
I mean, the president can tell the Justice Department to go after any of his enemies. Mm-hmm. He can tell the Pentagon to go after any of his enemies.
Absolutely. And again, this notion that somehow it's because we've got, again, this is how the opinion starts, we've got this very muscular executive view And again, executive branch, no doubt, is stronger than probably any of our founding fathers articulated. Supreme Court, a whole lot more powerful than anybody anticipated, right? But they articulate, the Chief Justice articulates this view that we've got to have an executive, a chief executive, a president who's able to be not only nimble, but able to work quickly, with muscularity, with power. And if you raise the possibility that you could be prosecuted for crimes, you're suppressing that capacity to be a true executive. That is a reversal of not only the Federalist Papers, that's a reversal of the entire premise upon which our nation has been premised, that we've got checks and balances between the executive branch and the judicial branch and the legislature, not that we've got this super presidency who's got to be able to do whatever he or one day she wants to do. As Sonia Sotomayor said, we've now got a loaded gun sitting there in the Oval Office ready to be used.
Yeah, they were worried about taking powers away from the presidency, but they didn't seem to entertain the downside of their own decision. I mean, at the oral arguments, they were talking about, is it okay for SEAL Team 6 to go after the opposing candidate? Right. They didn't even wrestle with that one.
Exactly. And again, counsel for Donald Trump basically said, yeah, that's where I'm going. Although, interestingly, even to your good point, Matt, Supreme Court went even further than what the counsel wanted them to do. Look at Sonia Sotomayor's dissent. She is the one who says, order the SEAL team to go and assassinate people in America, immune. Grant pardons based upon a bribe to me, to the president, immune. She says, immune, immune, immune. That's the world that you have now created. Interestingly, both she and Ketanji Brown Jackson, normally when people are dissenting on the Supreme Court, they say, I respectfully dissent. Both of them this time simply say, for fear about our future democracy, I dissent. There's no respect there. They're angry about this. Americans should be horrified by what happened.
Well, what do we do as Americans when we're horrified by the Citizens United case and by the Dobbs case and then by this immunity case? What recourse do we have?
So there are a number of things. One of them is, of course, you can do fixes. You can do legislative fixes for many of these things, including Dobbs. You can, as we have seen, people have introduced legislation in both houses of Congress that would do a Dobbs fix. You can do a Citizens United fix and address what the Supreme Court said was problematic, but do it in a way that would be a legislative accomplishment. All the Voting Rights Act, the John Lewis Acts, those are all remedying those cases in which the Supreme Court also, in part at the pen of John Roberts, said the Voting Rights Act does not mean what we thought it meant for all these years. You can do fixes of all those. Of course, how do you accomplish that? You got to get the right people in the House of Representatives, in the Senate, in the White House to sign off on that legislation, basically to overturn legislatively what the Supreme Court has done. That's one option.
The immunity would be a little harder to do legislatively.
It is much more difficult, although, again, there are senators who've introduced, including Elizabeth Warren, others introduced legislation to try to remedy that. It is more difficult, again, because it's this notion that the Constitution by itself incorporates an idea that our president is immune. But you can at least make that attempt.
Jim, in closing, I just want you to give us a little understanding of what you're trying to accomplish with your show, Amicus, a law review.
Sure. It's all about civics, right? Civic media operating and the notion that we want people who are educated, that we've got a sense of critical listening, but also critical argument, critical analysis. What we do is we take the relevant events of the week in the areas of government and law and justice and try to explain them, try to understand them in a nonpartisan, nonpolitical way, so that people can make their own decisions about the propriety or impropriety of what our government is doing, a greater understanding of how our government is working, state, local, and federal in particular, so that we can respond at the voting booth and also in public advocacy from a learned and an informed base.
I've got to say, it's one of the most informative and important shows on all of radio. While I'm scanning the dial on a Saturday morning, this is the show I always listen to.
Yeah,
Jim,
thanks
for being my guest.
Always a pleasure to be with you, my friend.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Wisconsin Forward podcast, and thanks once again for Jim Santel for being my guest. In our next episode, we'll be discussing the role that right-wing talk radio has played here in Wisconsin and around the country, and what we're doing here at Civic Media to address it. You won't want to miss that one. I'm Matt Rothschild, and thanks for listening to this latest version of the Wisconsin Forward podcast.